Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I have an SFB Online, Fed Come Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us. We have talk cast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the TalkShoe website at www.talkshoe.com. And search for call ID 17702 or Starfleet Universe On Call. Either way, you'll find us. And if you want to join us on Twitch, I co-broadcast over there. That's where actually I do the video stream. Somebody got confused and didn't realize that I only stream the video over on Twitch. I do not stream the video over on TalkShoe because TalkShoe doesn't give me enough controls for what I want to do. And as it is, well, having a problem with OBS. But anyway, so if you want to go over to Twitch, just go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall and you'll find us there and you'll be able to join the chat room over there. There's a lovely people that hang out there and they tend to chat amongst themselves, and I try to also answer any questions they have, trying to make sure that I can work that in seamlessly as possible. And of course, you need to contact me for any reason. My email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, just also you can follow the sfuoncall account. Or you can also follow the Paul Franz account, which is my personal account. Just a reminder that if you don't like people talking about the O's or being Catholic or tech, don't follow me. Otherwise, if you want to follow me, that's great. And of course, I have my other account, which is Franz Games, which you could use to follow the happenings of Franz Games. And of course, this lovely TalkCast gets into a podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. So quick news from AV this week. They actually have reprinted the Cadet Training Handbook and it's now available, both the ebook version and also the reprinted, you know, physical copy. It's no longer stapled in the middle. It's actually more like, if you remember the old Captain's Logs, it's more like one of those, or one of the SSD books, you know, that kind of thing. That's how it's put together, so it's easier to use. It's much easier to use in that form. Also, a quick thing, that Steve Petrick is out of the hospital and he dropped by the office. They're hoping to see him back in the office on a more permanent basis. Back in June, he has to have some cataract surgery because his eyes are really bad, and as is, he can't drive by himself. So they are, you know, looking forward to him getting that done and recovering from that and be able to come back in the office. And obviously our thoughts and prayers are with Mr. Petrick. Moving onward to SFB Online, we have, of course, the Sapphire Star 10 tournament. I hope I pronounced that right. It got to the semifinal round. Right now, we've got summary judgment in the Gorn versus Mad Jack in the Zindi, and also we have Kingzilla in the Ramen and KR versus Spartan in the Ramen and KR. Yes, we do have a civil war, which will be quite interesting given that they're both plasma ships going against each other, which makes it probably going to be a very long battle, or if someone decides to do a gutsy move and actually start using bolts instead of doing launching plasmas at each other, then things might be a little bit different, especially if he actually hits with those plasma bolts. I'm not sure who that would be. I'm just guessing that would be an alternative strategy from just chucking plasma torpedoes and turning away, because they're both going to be doing basically the same thing, I would think, at that point. And, of course, and I did do some work on Starfleet Warlord on my vacation. I actually did a little play around with GWT. It's basically, it's a way of programming the web, a web browser interface, you know, the web page, using Java, which is interesting because I know Java. And I play around with some, and I got the beginning parts of it done. I got it so that it can show the ship information, and of course it will then, after it shows the ship information, you know, it shows where you can do the moves. Now, the plan for this is really simple. It's going to be really simple. It's not going to check your movements at first. You know, the first step is have it so it just, you can upload your CSV file to that website. It will then load it into the browser, and then you can start working on your turn. And I'm thinking of either saving it what's called local storage in the browser, or allow people to actually save that off onto the disk, you know, save it locally and then keep that. So basically the idea is not that you load it up to the website and then it's always there. It's the idea is that you load it up to the website and everything's done within the browser itself. So there's no, it's not really saved per se. It can be if you don't blow away the cache of the browser. And if you know what that means, then you're more advanced and you know that what not to do. So that should be interesting. I'm hoping to get that done because I actually did some other work, which is the back end work, so that people can load up the CSV files, the CSV files, which are order CSV files. They're not the CSV files that currently exist, which are ship only. This is going to have ship and the orders, and of course, and also some additional information which we need to add and get that work done. And when it comes to SAP Online, no work done there this week. So with that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one and all, Paul Friends, welcoming you to Star of the Universe On Call. And tonight, we have, of course, me. And we have one, the only, the Barry. How you doing, Barry?
Hey, how are you doing? How are you
doing? Doing good.
I'm actually shopping right now, so.
That should be interesting. Hopefully we don't record someone screaming something in the middle of the Walmart or whatever store you're at.
No, I'm in a store which doesn't have what I'm looking for, so at least not everything. I think I may just
skip it.
Put what I did find back and go next door to the Rite Aid. Mm-hmm. They do have it, I don't know.
Okay. And of course, Gary, how you doing, Gary?
Not too bad. Hope everyone's doing well.
Yep. I'm doing good. So, my friends, one topic I had for this evening did not involve people. So I'm not sure how interesting it would be a topic for you guys, because I was going to discuss a simplified Starfleet Warlord aid, which I'm sure neither one of you actually is interested in whatsoever. So, do you have a different topic for us to talk about?
Well, so the question is, remember I had brought up something a couple of months back about how would a Klingon do if you replaced, I think, a couple of the disruptors with phasers or something like that?
Right, right.
That's a question.
Right. That almost sounds like... I was thinking about... I was thinking the... Like a fast D something. that the Klingons tried, but it wasn't replacing the disruptors with phasers. It was replacing disruptors with drones, if I recall correctly. Or was that? No, I'm thinking about the the Federation did that with their photons, replacing some photons with drone racks. With some
that
shit.
That would make sense.
But I agree to
that. There's the, I think in the Klingon Monster Starship book, there's a reference to a prototype. I think they call it the D7Z or something like that, where it was like, during the middle years, the Klingons didn't have, they weren't routinely able to develop the fire control mechanisms needed for Phaser 1. So they basically did a prototype cruiser where they basically installed the Phaser 1 in the disruptor mounts rather than. Because the bulk of the Phaser 1 fire control system was too big to fit onto the Phaser 2 mount that the ship itself had normally.
Oh.
But I don't think it was considered to be a success. But
okay.
I think they eventually turned it back into a regular disruptor arm cruiser.
So it was basically like a test platform kind of thing. Yeah, you're making a lot of noise there.
Sorry. You lost me for a minute or two. What happened was I turned on my car, and it said, "Oh, I'm going to grab the Bluetooth." And it's like, no. And it's like, I don't know how to do that while you're in the middle of a call. Screw you. You're not charging back to your AirPods. And it's like, now I had to pull the phone out of my pocket. Stop the car, pull the phone out of my pocket, and
switch it back.
Oh. Tell the phone. No. Mm-hmm. Screw the car. You're going to Bluetooth on to the AirPods.
Understood. I have a minor issue with my Jeep, but keeps on wanting to grab the Bluetooth, even when I'm out of the car. You know.
Oh, that's
annoying.
That's not good.
No, it's annoying. It doesn't really stop responding until it's kind of completely quote unquote shut down, you know. So it's a pain. But anyhow, as Gary pointed out, the where they replace the I love that. So Gary, basically, it was a test platform where they kept the Phaser 2s in place. They had not upgraded the Phaser 2s to Phaser 1s because the Phaser 1s were too large for the position where the Phaser 2s were currently placed in the ship. So they, as a test platform, they replaced the disruptors with Phaser 1s. Is that my understanding?
And they said it.
Yeah, it's basically because technically a Phaser 2 and a Phaser 1, they're the same weapon. It's just that the Phaser 1 has a more accurate fire control system. But while some empires like the Federation or ISC were able to refine it, where other empires like the Klingons and I guess the Lyrans as well were actually, did the Lyrans have Phaser 2s? Or am I thinking of someone else? Anyway, so other empires.
Their destroyers did.
So they struggled to.
I think.
Okay. Yeah. Pointing out the drone. I totally forgot that. Actually, the Klingons did do. Replace the disruptors as drones for their drone bombardment ships, which is like the D7D, the D6D, and the D5D as well. So, and did I lose everybody? Because I don't hear anybody.
No.
Okay.
This one. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear both. You guys were being very quiet, so I was...
Well, I didn't want to interrupt Larry's train of thought, although I guess there was a thing I was thinking about as well, but I'll leave it until Larry finishes his train of thought.
Yeah. So the... how many did they replace all the disruptors with phaser ones or just some of them?
All of them.
Oh, well, I was thinking more like half. Right. I was thinking of half of them. Yeah, all
of them.
That's
what you see on the Fast
B7. Be a problem.
Because Fast ships tend to replace half of their heavy weapons with more phaser mounts. I think the same thing is true with the Federation CF. It's got two additional phasers, but it's only got two photons.
And so the question is, how much of those seen play? Those fast ships.
I guess it'd be more of a campaign thing, because at the Federation fast ships have more like special rules in terms of how many hexes they can move a turn and so on, and how quickly they can react to opposing ships and so on.
Well, okay, so strategically they're faster, but in terms of
tactically, flexibility that swapping out the disruptors for phasers would give it. Now, of course, the big thing with swapping out two, basically half your disruptors for phaser ones, when it comes to the amount of power itself, you're saving power. But then you're also losing the flexibility of the longer range disruptors. So changes it into being a knife fighting ship. Saber Dance doesn't work nearly as well, because you want to be within range 5 with the phaser ones. To make up for the loss of punch when you replace a disruptor with a phaser one.
And if you replace the disruptors, then you're lessening the amount of damage you can do against Andromedan power absorber panels, because phaser ones don't have the quote-unquote disruptive effects that disruptors themselves have.
That is true. That is very true.
Against Andromedans, yes.
But I think the key point is just the reducing range. For the ranged attacks, you've just dropped so much damage, because you're not going to have a large number of those ships. Now I understand, Barry, that a lot of your fights have been duels, in a duel situation you don't worry about that kind of stuff, though again you're still going to have to worry about the tactics involved in that kind of ship. The crazy thing that I'm thinking about is between the Zinni and the Klingons. They both basically have the same armament. They have phasers, disruptors, and drone racks. The only difference between those two empires when it comes to the use of those has to do with the number. Zinnis usually have more drone racks and less disruptors. And of course, less the heavy phasers, phaser ones, and more of the phaser threes. So it makes them definitely, knife fight kind of ships. And then you got the Klingons that are more disruptors, more phaser ones, more heavy punch, direct fire, but less of the seeking weapons. That's less of the drones. That's the classical difference between those two empires. And then it comes to their ship designs overall.
Right.
And things like the,
now I got what I need.
Okay. And the one thing when it comes
right,
to
but I don't normally.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, but I haven't played the standard ships in forever because I only play tournament, which has four disruptors, and now the Zinni still has the drone advantage.
Right. Yeah, and
well, part of the issue could be as well that historically, because like a Klingon ship doesn't have a lot of padding, they're very Spartan in that design.
Especially when it comes to the front hull.
The modern era ships were being built, the Hydrans had already been defeated, so they didn't really debut their ships until about a decade after the Z6 started appearing. So the Klingons weren't really designing it to fight the Hydrans. What they were designing was to fight the Xintis and possibly the Lyrans, but most likely the Federation as well. So weapons, optimizing their ships to be able to keep away from, you know, overloaded photon torpedoes or waves of Xinti drones and stuff, would maybe that would favor leaning in on the disruptors more. Because, sure, the added phasers might help if you're dealing with drones, but because the drones were slow back then, just the fact the Klingon ship is so fast and maneuverable is more of a defense in and of itself, as long as unless you're like defending a planet or something.
Right.
And also, like, I guess with the Federation, they didn't have drone racks back then, so even the minimum drone racks the Klingon ship did have back then, that was an advantage that they could use, so they could try to chew up some of the phaser ones or tractor beams that the Feds had. So I guess in terms of like the overall, because I mean the Xinti ship, I guess the other thing too is that a lot of the middle years Xinti ships were designed to fight each other. That's why they had so many phaser threes and stuff. So because they were assuming that neither side would have
a powerful disruptor
hit. Yes. So and then. Or also with Lyrans as well, because I guess with Lyrans, those drones are helpful to try to wear down ESGs. So there's like advantages there. But I mean, because the Klingons don't have that other kind of system, like the kind of like they're, I guess, like not to say that the hulls are fragile, but they'd be wary about wading in too quickly. So maybe it would be less of a, in the broader sense of what their ships can or can't do. They might not necessarily be in super trickery to swap out those disruptors if they can help it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as was pointed out, with the disruptors that were replaced by drone racks, were those are mainly fleet support platforms, just like the ones in the Federation, where they replaced like the photons with drone racks. They were basically they were fleet support ships. They're never designed to be for one-on-one encounters. They're more of, okay, you want a lot of drones? Okay, well, I can give you a lot of drones. obviously with the Federation, for them, ultimate was their number of fighters that they would launch and launch all those drones along from the fighters.
Yeah, well
now I will say though.
This Barry?
Yeah, when they started building carriers and all that changed the whole complexion of the game from a direct fire weapon primary to drone primary.
Agreed. I know. Barry, have you read the designer's edition of SFB, the rules?
Yes. That was before the Commander's Edition, right?
That was before the Commander's Edition, yep.
Yeah, that's when I got started in the game, the designers. Plotted movement. By the way, 8-speed drones are much more effective with plotted movement.
That is very true. And also, when the drones could be launched was different. You didn't launch them in mid-turn.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. I think you launched them during energy allocation or right after.
Yeah, I think they were launched first, and like the plasmas were launched like last. Some like that. I actually.
Oh, were plasmas. Look.
Yeah, it was weird. I have to reread the designer's edition because that was one of those weird things in the designer's edition, which was the when it comes to the individual impulses, you didn't have nearly as much stuff to do as you do now. You know, you could now you can actually launch things in mid-turn. Back in the designer's edition, you couldn't.
Right. So that now correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying that plasma torpedoes were you made the decision to fire or not fire on the last impulse of the turn? Or
if I recall correctly, I just want to see if we can. I don't see it at the moment. I'm seeing if I can find the rule book on my computer, because I know I've got a copy of the rule book. I bought it from Warehouse 23.
Yeah.
This is.
Remember, the rules were numbered, not lettered.
Yeah, which was weird. Okay, right now.
Well, for that time, it was.
Oh yeah, okay. I got the pocket edition right now sitting in front of me, and sequence of play is this: number one, energy allocation; number two, speed determination; number three, self-destruction phase, so you can blow yourself up; number four, drone and shuttle launch phase; number five, sensor lock-on phase; number six is impulse procedure, which then you repeat for movement; and then fire decision, fire announcement, fire segment, damage out assessment. That's all a step six. That was A, B, C, D, and F. Step seven is plasma torpedo launch phase, which is after the impulses are done. And then finally, record keeping phase.
Right. Wow. So plasmas are launched on the last impulse of the turn.
After all the impulses are completed, yes.
Now, when do you make the decision that you're going to launch the plasma? That made at that point in the moment of launch, or at the during energy allocation?
Well, I had to look at the energy allocation for plasma because of if there is. I don't think there was. I'd have to reread the rules because of the question I have.
Yeah, here's the problem. With an R plasma, you've committed an energy allocation.
Right.
And you get to launch 32 impulses later. That's really, really scary.
Yep. And remember one thing.
What happens if...
Go. Just go.
Yeah, so you allocate to launch. I put in the full amount of power. And you did not have reserve power back.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't just contingently allocate and just say, yeah, finish it off.
Right.
And then if it came time to finish the turn, and remember, this was pre-plotted movement, so you had no idea where you were going to be. Well, you knew where you were going to be, but you didn't know where your opponent was going to be at the end of the turn. And if they were out of arc, You had a plasmar ready to go. That is, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, bear in mind that you can't, I guess you can roll and delay a plasma R now, okay? Is that right? Because you can't hold one unless you're a starving
correct.
Or something.
Correct. You could. But, you could
I guess back then, if your ship was only speed one, so.
But you couldn't. Here's the problem. If you put 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, the last turn army, you put 5 in. But you did mm-hmm. not have reserve power back then. So you couldn't just battery up the last 3 points and say go. You had to put that 5 points in during energy allocation, which meant it had to be launched on impulse or after impulse 32. Now, if you were out of arc, oh well.
Oh my.
You could be in arc when energy allocation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, ours are scary that way. Like, you've committed to launch 32 impulses later. You have no idea what the relative facings are going to be.
Agreed.
The relative positions. Facings.
Holy cow.
Or distances, you know.
Go back.
You know, he could have decided to run out that turn.
I guess the flip side would be that if you had a Gorn ship from back then, they only had plasma Gs, but
right.
You had more maneuver in terms of like where you're going to put them.
Yeah, well, the Gs didn't have that problem. It's like, it's out of arc, I don't fire, I can hold them.
Right. And the one thing, I'm looking at this, I was double-checking, triple-checking, and, wow. And of course, then you got
plasmas would have been seriously nerfed under those rules. Seriously, because you can't fire until impulse 32, which means that the other person has energy allocation, and their whole they have energy allocation after the plasma launch, and they can say time to run it out.
Yep. Oh, agreed.
Oh, yeah. Plasmas are useless. Because you really, with pre-plotted movement, try to guarantee that you're going to be close when it's time to launch is like, nah, not going to happen. I mean,
you can still do it. It's at least
with direct fire weapons. Direct fire weapons, you have a little flexibility there. Holy crap.
Oh, agreed. Remember a couple other things, too. I'm reading the Pocket Edition. It's a little different than the Designer's Edition. But two things. Number one, of course, with the Gorn torpedoes, they were also were only speed 20 versus speed 32. Number one. Number two, and I.
The Gorns were. Wait, what was this? The Gorn torpedo was speed 20?
Yes.
Oh.
Yep. And.
Oh, God.
And also, the Gorn torpedo could be held for 2 points of energy. But. And I had to double and triple check this, which is that the Gorn torpedoes and the Romulan torpedoes both required 225. So you got a 20-point torpedo that goes only speed 20.
225? Holy
crap. And
it
costs 225. So you have to pay the same thing as the Romulan torpedo, which was 50 points of damage versus 20 points of damage. And a 32 speed plasma versus a 20 speed plasma.
That's insane.
Oh, it's totally insane. And
yeah, well, the Gordons couldn't win a thing. That ship is so nerfed. Basically, its only weapons were the phasers. That's its reliable weapons. That's all you got.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fairness, that's all it needed, because remember, historically, during the Middle Ages, like, the Gorns, they hadn't countered the Federation or the ISC, and they didn't really have much of an issue with the Orion pirates, at least not immediately. So their main concern was, and the Praebians were dead, so the main issue was the Romulans, who didn't have, who still only had speed one, because they didn't have tactical warp drive. So from the Gorn perspective, even just having phasers was fine, because they could massively outmaneuver the Romulans in open space. So the only thing the Romulans could do is basically try to approach a planet under cloak and land on it, and then basically turn their ships into pseudo-plasma like ground batteries, and basically dare the Gorns to come in and drive them off. But they could do it. So generally speaking, like the Gorns didn't really have any kind of motivation to improve the situation until the Romulans were given warp by the Klingons. And then they were able to, like, add on additional phasers and plasmas and upgrade the plasma S and stuff. But, I mean, since the early editions of the game, of the universe, were mainly in the middle years, I guess they would, well, we don't, they wouldn't have thought of it as the middle years back then, I suppose. But looking back, I guess that's how we would frame it. Yeah, so, I mean, because the Gorns didn't have to worry about the Klingons or the Lyrans or whatever, or I guess even the Klingons didn't, the Xenzis didn't have to worry about the Lyrans because they weren't invented until a bit later. But, so, in the sense that each empire is basically just building ships with their immediate neighbors in mind, that maybe might explain some of the design choices that are being made there.
Right.
Because, like, for a Gorn ship, the all-around phaser arcs make sense if you've got Romulan ships that are both slow but have cloaks. So, in theory, you wouldn't be entirely sure which arc you're going to have to be shooting the Romulan at. But once you know where the Romulan is, he's basically a sitting duck, and you can dance around him. So you can basically feed phasers onto him, like, at your leisure. So there's not much he can do about it. It's only like when the Romulan ship can actually maneuver itself, then they've got a problem. So,
That's true. Yeah. If you're dealing with ships that cannot maneuver speed one max, then yes. Then a 20 speed torque is no big deal.
Agreed.
Although, of course, there is at least a couple of alternate universes where those middle years Gorn ships had their hands full with Paravian middle years ships, like the ones from Module C6, and that's when things get much more interesting.
Right.
Yeah. So, but still a Romulan sublight. Okay, so the Gorn is looking at this going, okay, so the Romulan is going to decloak. So when does he decloak? When does that happen?
Oh, cloak?
Does cloak go up or down?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Going through weapons, shields, optional rules. Security stations, shuttlecraft, damage, transporters, give me a sec. Remember, these are numbered, so I don't know where.
Oh, I know.
Where things are.
Yeah.
Cloaking device, optional. Romulan may be equipped with this device, which makes detection of the ship almost impossible. However, while the ship itself cannot be seen, the effects of the magnetic field on light from the background of the stars can be seen and give at least a general idea. Wow. The amount of power required for a cloaking device varies on the ship due to the size and electronic signature. The requirement for a warbird, that's the one that uses the impulse, 1 point of power. War Eagle, 6 points of power. Yeah. And KR, 20 points of power. Big surprise. I'm looking to see operation. Okay. It's not. So it's going to be. The vector of the effects. Okay. I don't see it. And let me double check again. Okay. Oh, that's neat. When the device is operating, the ship remains on the map, but an unused counter is placed on top, upside down to mark it. Okay. We just still have to move it. The amount of power required, it cannot be used during any turn in which the device cannot be used during any turn in which weapons are fired. Conversely, weapons cannot be fired during any turn that the cloaking device is operating. Note that the plasma torpedoes are fired at the end of the turn, and the ship must be visible during the entire turn in order to fire the weapon at the end of the turn. The effect of the device is to make it harder. My guess is that you did it during energy allocation.
Okay, so you decloak, you have a whole turn visible before you can fire.
Yep.
That's actually not too bad because now the plasmas can't fire until but end of turn. So, yeah. Now the Gorn can, of course, he can't control where he's going to be. Because that's pretty plotted. So.
Holy cow. Okay. Let me read this one rule, which I think is very interesting. In addition to the above effects, the player operating the cloak ship may keep track of its actual position on paper, placing the counter representing his ship within 3 hexes of the actual position. This may require services of a referee to judge firing angles, true ranges, and which shield is being hit, all of which are judged by the actual position, not the counter. So that means that the counter's placement on the map isn't actually where it is actually located. It's an approximation of where the ship is actually located. Wow.
Yeah, but you have some general, you know where that ship is going to be within 3 hexes. And because of that, you can pretty much say, okay, I'm going to be 5 hexes away from the Romulan, have my turn mode satisfied. And so if he decloaks at the beginning of the turn, let's say he decloaks at the beginning of the turn. I can set myself up so at the end of the turn, I'm within 5 hexes of where I expect him to decloak. I can probably have it set up so that I could say I have him slightly off my port, and I can make a turn to port so I can fire the left plasma. Only one shot of firing. But I can set things up so that I can unload the plasma and turn away from him and run out his R.
Right.
And he's got to be decloaked, so impulse 32. I can unload every phaser I've got, or even impulse 26, I can unload every phaser I've got at him. And then impulse 1, I launch a fire every phaser again and skedaddle. So now it's my 20-speed plasma, which will probably catch him before he can cloak again. Well, but the plasma does have its own guidance system.
Right.
So that's an interesting game to play. He's launched the plasma. I've launched my plasma. Mine will hit at the range 20, but his, who knows what range it'll be. If I've got enough speed, I could probably skedaddle out of range, you know, run out the plasma enough that it's severely weakened before it hits me.
Right. Agreed. I'm looking at the NSMs, the nuclear space mine rules, which are again optional. The Romulan Warbird and Romulan War Eagles each carry one nuclear space mine. This mine is not marked on the SSD and cannot be destroyed in combat. The mine may be dropped by the Warbird on any turn in the drone launch segment. Now, the mine can be maybe dropped by the War Eagle during any impulse of any turn. The dropping of the mine must be plotted. Must be plotted on the energy allocation form during energy allocation of the turn it has to be is to be dropped. In case of War Eagle type, the specific impulse must be designated.
Well, the War Eagle has a... Oh, the War Eagle can do that. Well, the War Eagle has movement. I'm going to need to mute you for a few minutes. I bought a neti pot because I've been suffering horribly with nasal congestion. I'm going to use that neti pot, but I'm going to mute while I'm using it.
Okay. So
I'm
listening, but please.
I'm just going to mute.
Please. So...
Oh, Paul, I was actually going to say that the Gorn would actually need to line up at least two firing opportunities because the offset phasers. So even before the Gorn launched its own plasma, it would have to kind of do like an S turn maybe to try to get, you know, and if there's only one run in ship with the genius. I guess that might complicate things.
Oh yeah, and as you pointed out, the one thing that the Gorn plasma itself had, which was a lot better arcs than the Romulan. Because Romulan, both the Warburg and the War Eagle, then this, because we're talking about the Pocket Edition, where there's only two ships. They have a little 60-degree arc that they can that they have for their torpedo, so which makes things quite difficult. Heck, to me that would actually be kind of an interesting thing to play. And that is a Warbird, you know, with you move once a turn, you can turn, go straight, whatever, you know. So you're not that maneuverable, and versus, you know, a Gorn. Now, that would be, in my mind, very interesting because it's very difficult because, obviously, you're both going to be launching at the end of the turn. So if the Gorn launches his plasma at the Romulan and it's not, you know, very close, and in that which case, obviously, you're going to probably get hit by the Romulan's torpedo. And that is that the Romulan can easily cloak, you know, at the beginning of the turn. Turn on the cloak. Boom, I'm gone. You know, and the one thing I don't think it mentioned here. These rules don't mention what the normal SSB rules mention, which is the whole idea of that if a seeking weapon hits a cloak ship, there's a shift involved. And you have this little chart. This doesn't have that chart. It just says that you have to add 10 to the range the first time a given ship fires at a cloak ship in a given scenario. And there's a This penalty is reduced by each turn that the firing ship fires at any cloaked ship to a minimum of three, which is a weird rule. You think about it. So basically, it's encouraging the person fighting the cloaked ship to fire at the cloaked ship as often as possible. Because after you can get...
Well, bear in mind that if you think about the tri-video broadcast, that's what the Federation CIA was doing. It was basically carpeting the area around the Romulan ship with fire to try to slowly kind of like zero in on it. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's probably what the rule had in mind when it was first written.
Agreed.
Actually, I was just thinking about how if someone was to retcon the Peravians back into the older version of the rules, would the quantum wave torpedo have the same firing restrictions as the plasma?
I would
and
think
so. Would that mean that both the Gorn and Peravian would have to wait until the end of each turn in order to plot their plasma or QWT launches?
Yep.
And if so, would that mean that both sides would be basically reliant heavily on their phasers rather than their seeking weapons?
Mm-hmm. I think you are correct. That it, because of it's a plasma type weapon, it'd be considered plasma weapon. In which case, a plasma weapons all fire at the last stage, almost the final stage of the turn. So.
I'm back.
Okay.
Oh, I'm doing so much better. Oh my God.
Good. I'm glad to hear. These rules make it the original version of the rules are very, very weird to any SFB player that have played Starfleet Battles later on. You know.
Yes. And I had forgotten that they were that bad. That made for a completely different game.
Yeah. Agreed. Which is, I kind of like it in that you could see how different of a game it was, and there to this day, I'm sure there's some people that either play the Pocket Edition or even the Designer's Edition, and it's like, okay, when they rewrote it in the Commander's level, in the Commander's Edition. I looked at the rules of the stack. Bah humbug, give me the old rules, and they'll never go off that, never play anything else but that again, because of the number of rules that got way too large. But Lord knows, I've talked about it multiple times, which is the Chris actually has mentioned the same thing, that he liked the Designer's Edition better than the Commander's Edition. And I can understand that. But as I mentioned multiple times on the whole thing about the thickness of the SFB rules is that it's the rules lawyers. The whole idea is that you want to define every single interaction between this weapon system and another weapon system. Not necessarily weapon systems, but it could be a ship system. Whether it's shields or PA panels or reactive armor, different kinds of armor, things like that. How does that those two things affect? And usually you have to go one or the other.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the Now, I don't know, and I don't know whether Steve Cole remembers what his thought processes were when he designed that game, but is it a possibility that he thought, writing this game, I better make it, let's see. The Romulans and the Klingons were traditional enemies, so I'm going to set that up. And the Feds and the Klingons are traditional enemies, so I'll set that up. And maybe the Romulans and the Feds are traditional enemies, so I'll set that out. And but nobody else is, but the Klingons wouldn't be fighting the Romulans, and the Gorns would only be fighting the Romulans. So maybe I don't need to have all those other interactions.
Right. Oh, I
other people said, well, it's...
Mm-hmm. I
and then maybe other people took.
Oh, Barry, I totally agree, and I'm sure part of that also was the sign of the times, because I'm not sure if you remember some of those games that they were selling back in the day, where there were these. I remember the one I remember the most is Warp War, and that you'd have these little baggies for this small little books. I mean, small little rule books that might be,
yeah, what,
10 pages long. And this is not 10, you know, 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. This is 10 pages of what? 3 by 5, you know?
Yeah.
Really small pages, you know? Yeah, pocket games, as Chris was mentioning in the chat. And he just also mentioned about it comes to the Designer's Edition versus the Commander's Edition, that the Commander's Edition, for him, didn't added much, a lot of complexity, but didn't add any enjoyment. And which, you know, again, that's what, you know, I think that some people that I've heard that you had these people that are, they will not move off of the Designer's Edition. They like the way it was simple back then, and that's the way they want to play it. You know, and I can understand that.
Well, there was another game. There was another Steve Cole game, Starfire.
Yep.
I remember. I played Starfire before I played Starfleet Battles. In fact, I found Starfire, and then somebody said, "There's Starfleet Battles," and I'm like, oh, okay. And then they said, yeah, it's by the same guy who created Starfire. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm actually looking right now.
Yeah.
At the book, the back cover talks about three different games in addition to Starfleet Battles. It had Cerberus. Cerberus was the first planet of another star to be reached by man, but it was already colonized by the Tal Ceti, and the Cetians wanted no visitors. Asteroid 04, both players command an asteroid base armed with missiles, laser towers, and manned spacecraft in this exciting game of space combat. And of course, lastly, Starfire. Starfire captures the suspense and terror of battles between fleets of space warships ranging from massive super dreadnoughts to lowly corvettes.
Yep.
Yeah, this was...
Now, here's an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Starfire, there was a collaboration between my favorite author, David Weber.
Right.
Steve Cole.
Mm-hmm.
And David Weber wrote a whole series of novels.
Yes, I know.
Based on Starfire.
Yep, I've read at least three or four of them.
Yeah.
Which was interesting, you know, some of the tactics that they was described in the books, you know.
Yes, yes. Well, they were all that combat was based around warp points.
Yep. Yep.
Actually, and the fact that when she...
Hmm? Continue.
Yeah, you could only send so many ships through a warp point at once. You know, there was a, and then when a ship went through the warp point for, I don't know, a minute or two after it went through, it was like going through the Wind Nebula. I mean, they were severely degraded for a minute or two after going through the warp point.
Right, right. Which is why people
would build, they build massive forts around the warp point, so that anything coming through would get blasted. And these were the forts that had no engines they were just basically weapons and armor and shields and no maneuverability, and that they were powerful and cheap.
Mm-hmm. I understood. Yeah, Chris, I never got to see the original Starfire. That was only one two-sided sheet of paper.
You never saw that? No, sure, I never saw that. Buy it on E23.
I'd have to check. Because remember, Steve Cole doesn't own the IP rights to Starfire anymore. He sold off those rights to I think Marvin Lamb, if I recall correctly.
Who's that? Never heard of him.
Yeah, I'm sure Steve Cole could. Marvin Lamb is the person who took over doing Starfire and actually expanding the rules and so forth, and expanding the empires that are, and Lord knows, the complicated build rules for Starfire. That was always the nuts part, because I actually bought a copy of Starfire. I forget it was 3 or 4.
So I used to have the original when it was Task Force Games or Amarillo Design Bureau.
Way back when I was in college, I actually bought Starfire 2. I remember buying that pocket game.
I never knew there was a Starfire 2. Okay, was that before or after Steve Cole sold the rights?
I think that was before. Yeah,
from what I understand, Weber and Cole were good friends at one point. I don't know if they've continued to keep in touch, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have no clue about they kept in touch, you know. But yeah, as I said, I read a lot of the Dave Weber books when it comes to the Starfire. I read, the first three, and Dave Weber, you know, obviously, he actually writes for multiple universes. One of my favorites for David Weber, which was Hammer Slammers. No, sorry, is that David Weber, or is that David Drake?
No, that was David Drake. That was David Drake.
David Drake, yeah, David Drake. I love Hammer Slammers.
Yeah. Now, Weber, there was who's the guy who did the Bolos series? Keith Lamar. You ever hear of the Bolos series?
No, I have not.
Oh, that was awesome. That was freaking awesome. And Keith Lamar wrote a whole bunch of those. And then David Weber wrote like one or two novels based on that universe.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it some interest. So basically, Keith Lamar wrote the Bolos series in the 1970s. And the Bolo Mark I was a slightly improved M1 Abrams tank. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a Mark II and a Mark III and a Mark IV. And they kept improving it, and they added computers, and they added, at some point, they put AI into these things. And by the Mark 35, this thing was fusion powered with a weapon called a Hellbore, which is probably where Steve Cole got the idea of the Hellbore for the Hydrings. But Bolo's Hellbores were basically, it looked like the main gun on a tank, and it was a plasma weapon, and it had a discharge rate of megatons per second.
Wow.
Of energy output.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, the longer it was firing its beam, the more damage it would do. I don't think it could sustain the beam for more than a second or so.
Right.
But still, if you know, you got 50 megatons per second in a beam weapon, holy crap. And they had armor and shield. And these bolos weighed, you know, they were getting up around 5,000, 6,000 tons.
Wow.
And they put AI in them, and they could, they had a human operator. The bolo system required a human operator who was mentally fused with the AI in the tank.
Wow.
And yeah, and it was they would send them in. The humans used the bolos to attack alien civilizations, and they were really, really freaking powerful, because you could basically drop them from orbit and they would land themselves, and they had even though there was a human commander to the thing, but when the human and the Bolo AI were operating in something called hyper heuristic mode, where their reaction time was like, well, I did that, and 12 microseconds later I saw that coming in, and they literally had reaction times like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And yeah.
Yeah, because Hammer Slammers had the same idea in that when it comes to the weapon for Hammer Slammers, they had the hover tanks with, I think, iridium armor, and the fusion engines that would send out these bolts of I'm not sure, fusion or whatever, and just blow things up.
The Hellbore was the main armament of direct fire armament of a Bolo.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had many, many, many weapon systems, you know, hundreds of drone missiles that could be fired indirectly.
Understood.
And they did, yeah, and they had shields, and they had lots and lots of point defense.
Cool. Okay, well, I think I'm going
to... Yeah, great series.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay, I think actually I'm going to wrap it up there. Seems like a good place to end this wonderful podcast. Barry, it's...
Next week I'm taking a red-eye home Wednesday.
Well...
So I will arrive Thursday morning at home, but I don't know what condition I'll be in at 9:30.
Well, that's fine, because I'm not going to have a podcast next week.
That makes it easy.
Right. Next week is Holy Thursday, and I'm part of the choir, so I'll be doing the Mass Thursday night. So I'm not going to have time to prep and get things all set for the podcast next week. So there will be no podcast next week. And I forgot.
Well, enjoy yourself.
I will.
Enjoying.
Okay.
You sound like you're going to have a good time.
Oh, I will. I love singing in the choir. It's really awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you have a good night.
Okay. Okay. Good night.
Bye. Gary, it's definitely been a pleasure having you around, and oy. Got to talk about some old games there.
Well, for what it's worth, I was actually hoping that we could talk about the quantum wave torpedo, because not just in terms of how it'd be used like in the module C6, but also how it might be used one day as an Omega weapon, because in terms of shooting at it or how much damage it does and that sort of thing. So
yes,
I don't know, like a few weeks from now, if there's a chance you'd have to review C6 or whatever, if we could go over it. But there might be other people who might want to check the Carnivon rules too, because like the disruptor cannon and death bolt and stuff, because that's what's interesting too. So
I will do, and Because I would love to discuss about the quantum, you know, the quantum torpedoes and definitely Module C6.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll see how it goes going forward. So good luck next week.
Okay, thank you. Have a good night. So, had a nice little discussion there a little bit about some crazy ideas that Barry had, and start talking about an old Starfleet Battles Pocket Edition. Wow. Remember, I never actually, I first copy of our boss Starfleet Battles was the Commander's Edition, so I never knew about the Pocket Edition. So it's I actually obviously it looks like I didn't actually buy a designer, just I bought the Pocket Edition. I know I went through the rules of the Pocket Edition before, which was interesting, and the whole idea of making a game out of that, you know, an online game, because it has everything I like about it. You know, it's definitely a challenge. I'm sure a lot of people would say, you know, well, you need to change things to make it more even and so forth, but you know, whatever. I'll have to wait and see if I ever get a chance to do that. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.